Chapter 7. At the height of the turmoil, the guest stretched out his hand, commanding peace. The authority of a great name and a great personality laid its mysterious compulsion upon the house, and it obeyed. Out of the panting calm which succeeded, the guest spoke, saying, with dignity and feeling, "This is serious. It strikes at an innocent life. Innocent beyond suspicion. Innocent beyond peradventure. Hear me prove it. Observe how simple a fact can brush out of existence this witless lie. Listen, my friends, that lad was never out of my sight yesterday evening at any time. It made a deep impression. Men turned their eyes upon Stillman with grave inquiry in them. His face brightened, and he said, 'I knew there was another one.' He stepped briskly to the table, and glanced at the guest's feet, then up at his face, and said, 'Colin, you were with him. You were not 50 steps from him, when he lit the candle, that by and by fired the powder. Sensation. And what is more, you furnished the matches yourself.' Plainly the guest seemed hit. It looked so to the public. He opened his mouth to speak. The words did not come freely. 'This is insanity, this,' Stillman pressed his evident advantage home. He held up a charred match. 'Here is one of them. I found it in the barrel, and there's another one there.' The guest found his voice at once. 'Yes, and put them there yourself. It was recognized a good shot,' Stillman retorted. 'It is wax, a breed unknown to this camp. I am ready to be searched for the box. Are you?' The guest was staggered this time, the dullest I could see it. He fumbled with his hands. Once or twice his lips moved, but the words did not come. The house waited and watched, in tense suspense, the stillness adding effect to the situation. Presently Stillman said, gently, "We are waiting for your decision." There was silence again during several moments. Then the guest answered, in a low voice, "I refuse to be searched." There was no noisy demonstration, but all about the house one voice after another muttered, "That settles it. He's Archie's meat. What to do now?" Nobody seemed to know. It was an embarrassing situation for the moment merely, of course, because matters had taken such a sudden and unexpected turn that these unpracticed minds were not prepared for it, and had come to a standstill, like a stopped clock, under the shock. But after a little the machinery began to work again, tentatively, and by twos and threes the men put their heads together and privately buzzed over this and that and the other proposition. One of these propositions met with much favor. It was, to confer upon the assassin a vote of thanks for removing Flint Buckner, and let him go. But the cooler heads opposed it, pointing out that addled brains in the eastern states would pronounce it a scandal, and make no end of foolish noise about it. Finally the cool heads got the upper hand, and obtained general consent to a proposition of their own. Their leader then called the house to order and stated it to this effect, that Fetlock Jones be jailed, and put upon trial. The motion was carried. Apparently there was nothing further to do now, and the people were glad, for, privately, they were impatient to get out, and rush to the scene of the tragedy, and see whether that barrel and the other things were really there or not. But no, the breakup got a check. The surprises were not over yet. For a while Fetlock Jones had been silently sobbing, unnoticed in the absorbing excitements which had been following one another so persistently for some time. But when his arrest and trial were decreed, he broke out despairingly, and said, "No. It's no use. I don't want any jail, I don't want any trial, I've had all the hard luck I want, and all the miseries. Hang me now, and let me out. It would all come out, anyway, there couldn't anything save me. He has told it all, just as if he'd been with me, and seen it. I don't know how he found out. And you'll find the barrel and things, and then I wouldn't have any chance anymore. I killed him, and you'd have done it too, if he'd treated you like a dog, and you only a boy, and weak and poor, and not a friend to help you. And served him damned well right. Broken ham sandwich. Ookie here, boys, from the constable : order. Order, gentlemen. A voice : did your uncle know what he was up to? No, he didn't. Did he give you the matches, sure enough? Yes, he did. But he didn't know what I wanted them for. When he was out on such a business as that, how did you venture to risk having him along and him a detective? How's that? The boy hesitated, fumbled with his buttons in an embarrassed way, then said, shyly, I know about detectives, on account of having them in the family, and if you don't want them to find out about a thing, it's best to have them around when you do it. The cyclone of laughter which greeted this native discharge of wisdom did not modify the poor little waif's embarrassment in any large degree. IV, from a letter to Mrs. Stillman, dated nearly Tuesday. Fetlock Jones was put under lock and key in an unoccupied log cabin, and left there to await his trial. Constable Harris provided him with a couple of days' rations, instructed him to keep a good guard over himself, and promised to look in on him as soon as further supplies should be due. Next morning a score of us went with Hillier, out of friendship, and helped him bury his late relative, the unlamented Buckner, and I acted as first assistant pallbearer, Hillier acting as chief. Just as we had finished our labors, a ragged and melancholy stranger, carrying an old handbag, limped by with his head down, and I caught the scent I had chased around the globe. It was the odor of paradise to my perishing hope. In a moment I was at his side, and had laid a gentle hand upon his shoulder. He slumped to the ground, as if a stroke of lightning had withered him in his tracks, and as the boys came running he struggled to his knees, and put up his pleading hands to me, and out of his chattering jaws he begged me to persecute him no more, and said, You have hunted me around the world, Sherlock Holmes, yet God is my witness I have never done any man harm. A glance at his wild eyes showed us that he was insane. That was my work, mother. The tidings of your death can someday repeat the misery I felt in that moment, but nothing else can ever do it. The boys lifted him up and gathered about him and were full of pity of him and said the gentlest and touchingest things to him and said cheer up and don't be troubled. He was among friends now, and they would take care of him, and protect him, and hang any man that laid a hand on him. They are just like so many mothers, the rough mining camp boys are, when you wake up the south side of their hearts. Yes, and just like so many reckless and unreasoning children, when you wake up the opposite of that muscle. They did everything they could think of to comfort him, but nothing succeeded until Wells Fargo Ferguson, who is a clever strategist, said, If it's only Sherlock Holmes that's troubling you, you needn't worry anymore. Why? Asked the forlorn lunatic, eagerly. Because he's dead again. Dead. Dead. Oh, don't trifle with a poor wreck like me. Is he dead? On honor, now is he telling me true, boys? True as you're standing there, said Ham Sandwich. And they all backed up the statement in a body. They hung him in San Bernardino last week, added Ferguson, clinching the matter, whilst he was searching around after you. Mistook him for another man. They're sorry, but they can't help it now. They're building him a monument, said Ham Sandwich, with the air of a person who had contributed to it, and knew. James Walker drew a deep sigh, evidently a sigh of relief, and said nothing, but his eyes lost something of their wildness, his countenance cleared visibly, and its drawn look relaxed a little. We all went to our cabin, and the boys cooked him the best dinner the camp could furnish the materials for, and while they were about it Hillier and I outfitted him from hat to shoe leather with new clothes of ours, and made a comely and presentable old gentleman of him. LD is the right word, and a pity too. Old by the droop of him, and the frost upon his hair, and the marks which sorrow and distress have left upon his face, though he is only in his prime in the matter of years. While he ate, we smoked and chatted, and when he was finishing he found his voice at last, and of his own accord broke out with his personal history. I cannot furnish his exact words, but I will come as near as I can. The wrong man's story, it happened like this. I was in Denver. I had been there many years. Sometimes I remember how many, sometimes I don't, but it isn't any matter. All of a sudden I got a notice to leave, or I would be exposed for a horrible crime committed long before, years and years before, in the East. I knew about that crime, but I was not the criminal. It was a cousin of mine of the same name. What should I better do? My head was all disordered by fear, and I didn't know. I was allowed very little time, only one day, I think it was. I would be ruined if I was published, and the people would lynch me and not believe what I said. It is always the way with lynchings. When they find out it is a mistake, they are sorry, but it is too late, the same as it was with Mr. Holmes, you see. So I said I would sell out and get money to live on and run away until it blew over and I could come back with my proofs. Then I escaped in the night, and went a long way off in the mountains somewhere, and lived disguised, and had a false name. I got more and more troubled and worried, and my troubles made me see spirits and hear voices, and I could not think straight and clear on any subject, but got confused and involved, and had to give it up, because my head hurt so. It got to be worse and worse, more spirits and more voices. They were about me all the time, at first only in the night, then in the day too. They were always whispering around my bed and plotting against me, and it broke my sleep, and kept me fagged out, because I got no good rest. And then came the worst. One night the whisper said, "We'll never manage, because we can't see him, and so can't point him out to the people." They sighed. Then one said, "Colin, we must bring Sherlock Holmes. He can be here in 12 days. They all agreed, and whispered and gibbered with joy. But my heart broke, for I had read about that man, and knew what it would be to have him upon my track, with his superhuman penetration and tireless energies. The spirits went away to fetch him, and I got up at once in the middle of the night and fled away, carrying nothing but the handbag that had my money in it, $30,000. 2/3 of it are in the back there yet. It was 40 days before that man caught up on my track. I just escaped. From habit he had written his real name on a tavern register, but had scratched it out and written Agate Barclay in the place of it. But fear gives you a watchful eye and keen, and I read the true name through the scratches, and fled like a deer. He has hunted me all over this world for 3 years, and a half the Pacific States, Australasia, India, everywhere you can think of, then back to Mexico, and up to California again, giving me hardly any rest. But that name on the registers always saved me, and what is left of me is alive yet. And I am so tired. A cruel time he has given me, yet I give you my honor I have never harmed him nor any man." That was the end of the story, and it stirred those boys to blood heat, he's sure of it. As for me, each word burned a hole in me where it struck. We voted that the old man should bunk with us, and be my guest and Hillier's. I shall keep my own counsel, naturally, but as soon as he is well rested and nourished, I shall take him to Denver and rehabilitate his fortunes. The boys gave the old fellow the bone-smashing good fellowship handshake of the mines, and then scattered away to spread the news. At dawn next morning, Wells Fargo, Ferguson, and Ham Sandwich called us softly out, and said, privately, "That news about the way that old stranger has been treated has spread all around, and the camps are up. They are piling in from everywhere, and are going to lynch the professor. Constable Harris is in a dead funk, and has telephoned the sheriff. Come along." We started on a run. The others were privileged to feel as they chose, but in my heart's privacy I hoped the sheriff would arrive in time, for I had small desire that Sherlock Holmes should hang for my deeds, as you can easily believe. I had heard a good deal about the sheriff, but for reassurance's sake I asked, "Can he stop a mob? Can he stop a mob? Can Jack Fairfax stop a mob?" Well, I should smile. Ex-desperado 19 scalps on his string. K can he? Oh, I say. As we tore up the gulch, distant cries and shouts and yells rose faintly on the still air, and grew steadily in strength as we raced along. Roar after roar burst out, stronger and stronger, nearer and nearer, and at last, when we closed up upon the multitude massed in the open area in front of the tavern, the crash of sound was deafening. Some brutal roughs from Daly's Gorge had Holmes in their grip, and he was the calmest man there. A contemptuous smile played about his lips, and if any fear of death was in his British heart, his iron personality was master of it, and no sign of it was allowed to appear. Come to a vote, men. This from one of the Daly gang, Shadbilly Higgins. Quick, is it hang, or shoot? Neither, shouted one of his comrades. He'll be alive again in a week. Burning's the only permanency for him. The gangs from all the outlying camps burst out in a thunder crash of approval, and went struggling and surging toward the prisoner, and closed around him, shouting, fire! Fire's the ticket! They dragged him to the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.